was the best thing ever to happen in Ireland, ever.
There was definitely more than one funeral I heard about at the time where there was actually a TV at the back of the church.
There wasn't one person who wasn't absorbed for those 3 weeks. The whole nation came to a standstill.
We've qualified for the World Cup. Go and compete.
Music and memories of 1990, the year of a World Cup, and a moment which ranks high in Ireland's sporting and social history. Far from just being a football tournament, the 3 weeks that summer in which Jack's Army reached the quarter-finals of football's showcase event and enchanted an entire nation, turned out to be one of the most memorable events in our history. It can even be argued that after Italia 90, things were never quite the same again. Welcome to Italia 90, the nation's ballgame. There's no doubting that Ireland's odyssey in the World Cup of 1990 was more than just an event for football fans. It was one in which the entire nation became completely captivated and enchanted. Buntings and flags adorned houses and businesses throughout the land, while fans raided savings accounts and mattresses to follow their heroes all across Italy. The celebrations weren't confined to mainland Europe, as pubs and sometimes streets too became filled with joyous fans who give broadcasters ratings the likes of which have never been seen before or since. For people of my generation, I was 4.5 in the summer of 1990. It's an event we remember, though not clearly. We've seen footage of all the goals, of Paddy's save, and even some of the Irish fans in Italy and here at home. But we don't really remember, I found, just how immense an event this was. We don't recognise how everything changed immensely during those 3 weeks, and how things were never quite the same again afterwards. To tell this story and to try and figure out whether Italia 90 led to any lasting change here, I travelled across Ireland 20 years after this World Cup to collect the stories of fans, those who were there and those who were here, to talk about their experiences and their lasting memories of Italia 90. The journey to that World Cup, Ireland's first, began long before that summer. Fans of the Irish national team had endured decades of hardship and countless near misses throughout the years. After failing to reach the competition in Mexico 1986, a Newcastle native by the name of Jack Charlton was appointed to the position of manager of the Irish football team. His first campaign in charge was when they attempted to qualify for the European Championships of 1988, but after completing all of their games, it looked like Ireland's fans were set for another disappointment. Ireland needed Scotland to go to Sofia and upset Bulgaria and their impressive home record. The Scots were already eliminated and had nothing to play for, so there was little optimism here in Ireland, even after Gary Mackay gave them the lead minutes from time. Author and journalist Declan Lynch watched the game in a bar in Dublin, along with a number of friends, among them Arthur Matthews, who would go on to co-write the TV series Father Ted.
It was a day when we didn't expect anything to happen because, you know, Scotland needed to win in Bulgaria for Ireland to qualify, and that was obviously not going to happen. These were just, you know, a few lost souls sitting around Ireland waiting for the inevitable to happen, which was something bad. And we were in this vein until, absurdly, Scotland scored with a few minutes to go, which only traumatised us further because now we realise that it can be snatched away from us. There are still about 4 minutes to go. We figured, how are we going to get through this 3 or 4 minutes? And Arthur had this brilliant idea. He said, just think of it like this. Teenage Kicks by the Undertones last for 3 minutes exactly. That's about how long there is left in the game. And so the three of us started in our heads going through Teenage Kicks by the Undertones. And it somehow made the time go quicker. It didn't stop the Bulgarians shaving the outside of the bar once. And then astonishingly, Ireland were through, and the RTE studio, it was this place of madness. People like John Giles was there, I think Mick McCarthy was there. All of them astonished. Jack wasn't anywhere near the place. Jack was going to watch the match, I think, on Eurosport. But he didn't realise that Eurosport don't show them live. So he was supposedly watching the match, and someone rang him to tell him that Ireland had qualified.
Ireland Ireland had qualified for their first major championships, a huge occasion for football fans here. At the time, just 8 sides reached the European Championships, and Ireland were placed in a tough group alongside Holland and the USSR, and also the old enemy England, against whom we would play our first game. Though she was just 9 years old at the time, Niamh McCormack remembers the day well.
I really vaguely remember my dad and my older brothers building up to the match, particularly because it was England and it was obvious, well, it was England. Everyone was on about it, and they had to explain to some of the younger in my family what exactly it all meant. Now looking back, I realise what a big deal it was, but at the time I probably didn't. I'm like, they were typical Irish fans. They were severely pessimistic, and Dad was probably the worst of all of them. We'd invited a couple of our friends over, family, neighbours, and everyone turned up in green. When Houghton scored, there was uproar. The whole place just burst out. Poor little sister started crying with all the noise, but I can't say anyone took any notice of her. We still joked that they could hear us over in Stuttgart.
Dubliner John O'Sullivan has clear memories of that afternoon, even though he didn't actually get to see the match.
I was actually on a cycling event the day of the England game, and I remember it. I was up in the middle of the Wicklow Mountains, and I was listening to it on a Walkman. And the next thing, Ireland scored. There was 2 lads about 20 yards ahead of me, and I let such a roar, they nearly fell off the bike. They didn't know what was happening, you know.
Oh, with their Union Jacks, all them English fans, for victory they were set. Until Ray Houghton got the ball and he stuck it in the net. Hey!
Despite that win over England, Ireland were eventually eliminated in the group stages of Euro 88. A fantastic Ronnie Whelan strike earned us a draw against the USSR, but an unlucky loss to Holland put paid to our chances. However, the usual doom and gloom surrounding the Irish fans was no more. Instead of hoping and praying for qualification and treating it as a dream, the performances of the side led to a newfound hope that we could reach the World Cup 2 years later. To do this, Charlton would have to lead his men to a top 2 placing in a group that included Spain, Hungary, Northern Ireland and Malta. Things started poorly with 2 draws and a defeat in their opening 3 games, but a run of wins turned our fortunes around. And as Brian Hensey explains, a mood that began as one of cautious optimism grew throughout the campaign.
I think it was still largely a hope, but it quickly turned into an expectation. You know, I think, you know, when the results were quite good, in the early matches, you know, people did begin to think, yeah, this could really happen. I mean, the home game against Spain was a huge. Was a huge one and a huge watershed, I think, in Irish soccer. You know, I mean, we won it with an own goal on a very bumpy pitch. A pitch that was bumpy on purpose. You know, Jack was well known for these kind of tactics. That was an incredible occasion, which really, really did turn the corner for Irish soccer. From there, I think people expected, and you know, it came about. I mean, wins over Malta and Hungary at home. I mean, just incredible occasions at Lansdowne Road.
Those results left Ireland in a simple position heading into the final game away to Malta. Though it would turn out to be unnecessary, management, players and fans knew a win in Valletta would guarantee that the long wait to take part in a World Cup would come to an end. Along with his wife, Dubliner, Mark Fitzgerald was one of many Irish who had emigrated in the 1980s and was living in the American state of Connecticut at the time.
We used to drive down to the Bronx, and there's an Irish mile down in the Bronx, and there could be 50 Irish pubs down there. And not all of them had the matches, but most of them did. But you were going into a packed bar. It was very surreal in a way, because you get so excited, and it was a good result for Ireland, which it was. You don't know what to do with yourself for the rest of the day, because you're hyped up, ready to rock and roll, and it's not even midday yet. But the amount of Irish people over there at the time, it was like there was more people going out of here by the week in the 80s than you could ever imagine. You know, last one out, turn out the light kind of thing. And there was an awful lot of Irish people over there.
Closer to home, meanwhile, there's no doubting that the match in Malta was an occasion here as well. Declan Lynch, who, to use his own term, was one of the lost souls who watched Scotland beat Bulgaria 2 years previously, recalls the day.
I was working with the Hot Press at the time, and the Hot Press, very extravagantly, books a room in Saks Hotel, and various, you know, rock stars such as Joe Elliott of Def Leppard were at this thing, you know. Hot Press organised the thing, and it was a great sense of occasion. But there was this weird drama as well, because fog had descended on Dublin Airport, and there were all these people trying to get out to witness this landmark in Irish history. And there were harrowing scenes on the news of some woman, for example, weeping, you know, literally weeping, saying, you know, we can't get off the island. We can't. We're stuck here. Somehow the fog lifted and they all got over and saw Ireland beating Malta 2-0.
In the summer, in the sunshine, we're off to Italia for the World Cup. We're getting wound up to support the best team in the land. For the first time, and not the last time, the Irish lads have qualified. All the fans have a message for the manager. In unison they all will cry, you're the last Jack, you're the last Jack. Never, never, never say no. Ireland, Ireland, Republic of Ireland, rebel up and here we go.
A 2-0 win put Ireland into the World Cup and ultimately into a group not too dissimilar to that of Germany 2 years earlier. The USSR were replaced with Egypt, a match which was supposed to be a formality. But again, Ireland were to finish the competition's first round with a clash against Holland and open it with one against England. Mark Fitzpatrick flew home to Ireland before travelling on to Italy for the competition. He remembers the scene that greeted him on his arrival and how it was obvious that the whole nation was building up for the competition.
It was very inclusive. I think everybody, from mothers, daughters, grannies, men, women, you know, and children, they all got the same buzz out of it. Probably the people who knew soccer a bit more, knew football a bit more, got a bit more out of it. But everybody got something out of it. You know, the every lamppost in Dublin was painted green, white, and orange. There was bunting everywhere. There was graffiti, murals, and all that kind of stuff on the walls. And the weather was fantastic as well, which didn't hurt either, you know. And it was a great summer, and I think it was a great summer for Irish people in general.
Ireland's first ever match in a World Cup was against England and was held in Calgary on Monday, the 11th of June. Brian Hensey was one of the lucky few who were in the stadium that night. He remembers the day well.
We actually stayed in what was then Yugoslavia. We were staying on the coast of what was present-day Croatia, and we were flying in from Split into this place. So we were into Calgary very, very early in the morning. They brought us into some car park or something, I said, to keep us away, apparently, from the England fans. And it turned out we were right beside the dock where a whole shipload of England fans arrived. Anyway, but that was early in the morning. They brought us to a beach then for the day. But I remember going to the match. I remember the amazing feeling of travelling by coach to that match with fans hanging out the windows of high-rise buildings all around and waving Italian and Irish flags. You know, it's pretty obvious who they were favouring on the day. The huge numbers of Irish fans, relatively small number of English fans compared to us. The match itself, obviously, well, we got off to the worst possible start with the goal down in the first 10 minutes. Gary Lineker and... then before half time, or just come up to half time, it started absolutely lashing rain. We had an electrical storm. We were absolutely soaking wet. So things were getting, I suppose, worse and worse. Right to half time, it rained into the second half. It rained. We weren't looking like there was any real chance of us getting back. And then suddenly, out of the blue, the rain stopped. And the next thing we know, it again looked like another attack had broken down. But Kevin Sheedy won the ball. And I was a long way away, but I was right behind the shot, so I knew as soon as he hit it, I could say, that's just inside the post. I think I ended up four rows back from where I was sitting because I don't know how it got there. So that'll tell you what it meant. Quite an amazing goal, you know, and I still remember it like it was yesterday, even though it's so long ago, you know.
Declan Lynch also recalls that in the build-up to the match against the English, the psyche of the Irish fans was very different to that portrayed in the songs of the time. While musicians promised that Ireland would shock the world and bring the World Cup back to Dublin, he remembers that this unbridled optimism wasn't how people actually felt. He believes fear was the most prevalent emotion and thinks that this is why a draw against the English and not a win like in Stuttgart 2 years earlier was more than enough to send the country into delirium.
The overriding mood was one of terror. Destroy Ireland, right? And in an odd way, Jack Charlton was very Irish too in this sense. Jack didn't believe that we could win the World Cup, but he believed that we could do certain things up to a point. But as long as we didn't just disgrace ourselves, we'd be all right. And this was very Irish. You know, as long as we kind of got away with it, as long as we weren't just hockeyed by these guys, then it'd be okay. But there was real fear you know, even at this stage, even though we had a very good team, if you look back on it, probably on an individual basis, Ireland had better players than England, but we couldn't see that at the time. Just the weight of history, the weight of our culture, all that's wrong with us as a people was brought into this. I mean, the huge inferiority complex. On the big stage, finally, we were going to get a going over by these guys. So when the Sheedy goal went in, the sense of just jubilation that spread around the country, it was just utter madness. I mean, the relief of it, you know. You'll note that after that, we had no idea that we were going to win the match. We didn't care about that, you know. Yet here again, despite having more or less better players, we were so happy not to get beaten, and certainly not to get beaten badly, that we just thought we'd died and gone to heaven.
The one all draw marked the first of what was to be several Irish celebrations in Italy that summer, and as Brian Hensey remembers, the locals were more than happy to join in, even those that weren't supposed to.
Another thing that a lot of us spoke about after was the security in the stadium, you know, the number of police that were there, armed police with dogs and that, sitting up amongst us ever since we went 1-0 down, because they expected the obvious reaction. But by the end of the game, they'd actually put the guns down and they were singing with us, you know. It was the first of many occasions like that, you know. But of course, yeah, going back then to the coach and travelling through the city, which just, I mean, it was like we'd won the World Cup, to be perfectly honest, you know.
Following the draw against the English, Mark Fitzpatrick, who had travelled all the way from the United States, arrived in Palermo for the second game against Egypt. He remembers how on their arrival, the Irish fans bonded with the locals and left their own indelible mark.
We were all eager to get out of the airport and into the coaches and to the game. But a couple of things happened. First off, the plane parked up on the tarmac, and we got into buses. And as we approached the terminal, we could see the Carabinieri outside with their machine pistols. And they were either side of the door. There must have been maybe 12 abreast, or 12 either side. It was quite intimidating, you know, and as you pull up in the bus, we're kind of looking out saying, you know, what have we got into here? But the first Irish guy got out and he sprinted over to the first guy, put a scarf around him, Irish scarf, and gave him an Irish teddy. So all of a sudden it didn't look so intimidating, you know. They had a machine pistol but a teddy, you know. It was quite funny, you know. So we got inside a terminal, and now we've got 300 guys trying to get out of a terminal, and the carousel delivering the bags was so small, it was unreal. It was maybe about 15 feet deep, there was only maybe 6 or 7 bags on at any one time. There was 300 people, bedlam. But we sorted it out of an Irish solution to an Irish problem. A couple of guys got inside the carousel, started lifting up bags, calling out names, Murphy, Kevin, that's me, and they throw the bag out, and, you know, Sweeney, here we go. And all of a sudden the bags were cleared, and it was unreal. It was 4 or 5 minutes, everybody had their bags. I think they realised, I don't think they knew what to expect, but as soon as we left the airport, I think they realised that they weren't going to have any problems with us. And they didn't. And the Irish police, we police each other out there all the time. If someone stepped out of line, someone said, excuse me, you're an ambassador for Ireland. And that happened. I seen it happen.
Along with Mark, Corkman John Peavoy also joined up with the Irish fans from the second game onwards. However, he managed to get to Italy through different methods altogether.
I was in college in UL, in the university in Limerick. We were doing our finals. So getting prepared for Italia 90, being prepared to actually watch it at home on the TV. But I'd done a competition on Century Radio with Claire McKeown, and thought nothing about it, sent it off 3 or 4 postcards in those days, you know. And I was in the canteen one day in UL, and someone said, oh, I heard your name on the radio. And I said, really? And they said, yeah, I think you won something. Oh, and I passed no more remarks. But 2 days later, someone said, they're looking for you on the radio, you know, because I had no mobile phone. It was before mobile phones. It was about 2 or 3 weeks before the exams. And actually, we all used to squirrel ourselves away studying. So I was uncontactable. We had no phone in the student house. You know, I used to phone home from the payphones every day or every week, whatever. So anyway, it took me about 3 or 4 goes using the payphones in the college, ringing Century Radio, didn't know what time Claire McKeown was on. She used to be there. She used to ring back the payphones. People couldn't find me. So eventually, anyway, I found out it wasn't a spoof, that I had actually won a trip to the World Cup. The problem was I was doing my exams and I went, oh my God, what am I going to do? It turned out the flight from Dublin to Sicily was the evening after I finished my last exam. Fitted perfectly. So as it happened, I finished my exam in Limerick on the Saturday morning, got on a train up to Dublin, got to the airport, and I was in Palermo that evening.
The match against Egypt marked what is probably the low point of the competition, and not just from an Irish point of view. Italia 90 produced the lowest goals per game average of any World Cup in history. This match typified the cynical and negative play often seen. Egypt in particular were content to sit back and spoil the match for the Irish, who under Jack Charlton were never the best at imposing their will on a supposed weaker side. Throughout the 90 minutes, neither side managed a shot on target. John remembers how it was a frustrating afternoon.
I can still remember it as being probably one of the most frustrating games I have ever been to in my life. It was a real come down. It was a real deflatory experience where, you know, I remember just watching it and this game was just so dull. Grass growing would have been way more exciting. And I was very, very disappointed because, not even just because the game was so poor, but it was actually mostly because the referee and the officials let the Egyptians destroy a game of football. You know, we were never going to be a hugely attacking team anyway in those days, but at the same time it was really disappointing the way it was allowed to develop, and it was 0-0 from the first minute and it was 0-0 at the end.
Despite the disappointment of this performance, the Irish fans in Italy continued to enjoy themselves. Some of the fans opted to stay outside of Italy in places like the then Yugoslavia and fly in for each match. One of those who took this course of action was Brian Hensey. He says the party atmosphere was very much in evidence there.
And we had an amazing time there. You know, there was actually a guy who had a little kind of burger and beer joint near the hotel, and we'd kind of embraced, and he'd embraced us as you know, he was, his place would be decked in Irish flags, as the few lads he had working for him all had the jerseys on. And they actually had they'd killed a sheep for us coming back that night, and they were going to cook that for us the next day. So we had a great party back there. Friendships were made there that have lasted since. We still meet some of the same people, you know, 20 years on, we meet them at the matches.
While John Peavoy remembers one Irishman in particular to whom some of the locals took a particular shine.
We stayed in a place called Messina, which was over along the northeast coast, and it was about a 3 or 4 hour coach ride to the matches. But, you know, there was a good group there. There was one group in particular, there was a father and son garage owner from Dublin. Real dub. Huge characters, absolutely amazingly funny guys, closed down the garage, closed their whole business because this was a real opportunity they didn't know they were ever going to see again. They all just shut up shop. They'd saved their money up to then, you know, in the time before the tournament. And all just, you know, himself and his son came out. The guy himself, we used to walk down in the morning, very hungover from the night before in the hotel, walk down into the town, down this hill, down to a small cafe bar, as they have in Italy, which was used to serve beer and ice cream. The same guy used to sing Just One Cornetto all the way from the hotel down to the cafe.
Just one cornetto, give it to me, delicious ice cream.
After about the second day, he had between 15 and 20 kids that used to follow him, like the Pied Piper, to the cafe. He'd order himself, me and his son a beer, and he'd order the kids an ice cream each. And this happened for the whole week after the second day, and it was just so much fun. And he used to sing while he was drinking the beer, and the kids would be dancing around him and playing football around him. It was surreal. It was like something you'd see in a film. But he did it every morning, and the kids used to be listening out for this guy singing Just One Cornetto, walking past their windows, and the kids would come out of the house, run behind him, and he'd buy every single one of them an ice cream. And it was just such a fun time.
Two draws from two meant that in order to reach the second round of the competition, Ireland would have to do what they couldn't 2 years previously, namely secure a result against Holland. Being drawn in Group F alongside the English meant that the matches and as a result most of the fans were based on the island of Sicily. Italian 90 came following incidents at Heysel and Hillsborough, and some felt that placing England in this group and basing them off of mainland Italy was a bit to isolate their fans, at least for the group stage. FIFA denied that this was the case, but as Mark Fitzpatrick recalls, security was tight for all fans based in the area, with a number of draconian measures in place. However, he remembers how the Irish were given a helping hand by the locals in avoiding some of these.
24 hours either side of the game, there was a ban on alcohol, and you know, it was difficult to get a drink. You know, not that you necessarily needed a drink, but you couldn't get one. But on the Thursday, we'd been there since Sunday. On the Thursday, we were asked, to all the Irish guys going to the game, to the Dutch game, to go to, there was an outdoor theatre in the place. And when we arrived, they were playing Irish music, and they had this tricolour cake, possibly as big as the table. The table was about 3 feet, 3.5 feet by 1.5 feet, green, white and orange. And they said, have some cake. And to be honest, we didn't really want cake, but they insisted. And they'd put in so much alcohol into the cake, right, you could get drunk on the cake.
All across the country, fans tuned into the match from Palermo and were dismayed as the Dutch took an early lead. However, a strike from Niall Quinn secured Ireland a 1-1 draw and sparked yet more celebrations. One of the fans who watched the match did so in a bar in Limerick. His name was also Niall Quinn.
The Holland game itself, you're kind of going, these guys are just, they're another class, like, you know. And I think we were only 8 minutes in when Hullett scored for them, and we went, oh, here we go. At least it was 8 minutes from the end in Germany, like, you know. But now they had time to sort of like play with us before they ram in a second and a third. Like. So, no, it was a great performance after that. I remember when the ball, massive long clear out from Packy, and it bounced once, and somebody was supposed to put a foot through it at that stage, and they didn't. And it just, my namesake ran onto it. And I think it got the whole way back to Van Breukelen, who's the Dutch keeper, and he fumbled it a bit. And Quinny just slid on the thing. And when I saw it go off his foot, I was going, oh, he's ballooned it. I thought, I thought it was going to go over for a point. Like, and it didn't. It went into the sort of roof of the net and dropped down again. And, you know, pandemonium. It was an awesome moment. It really was. So the 3 points started arriving at me shortly after that, which was pretty much the only time it came in useful. It was pretty embarrassing the whole time having the same name as Niall Quinn prior to that, you know. It was a great, great day.
As Niall said, the match finished 1-1, but not until a rather unusual episode occurred near the end of the game. Realising that the result would send both sides through, captains Mick McCarthy and Ruud Hullett essentially agreed a ceasefire. Both sides knew a goal for the opposition would knock them out, so 1-1 was agreed as the final result. The teams played out a leisurely closing period of the match. John Peevoy was again in the stands.
I'm not sure exactly how, whether we knew beforehand, I can't remember. I was behind the goal where we scored, and we were there, and we knew as things started to evolve, we were sort of, it dawned on us, the realization dawned on us, hey, you know, we're going to go through here. And everyone just started, it gradually built into a real crescendo of just fun, enjoyment, elation, all of the, you know, all the emotions you could imagine. And it was just such a great, great experience. And rather than just having it, feeling it at the end of a game, it was an extended period, like for 10 minutes or whatever, where you were going, you know, it was just such an enjoyable experience. It was superb.
The truce between the sides, for the want of a better term, meant that the Republic of Ireland finished level with Holland in Group F, and not just on points, but in every single tie-breaking scenario. Lots were to be drawn to see whether Ireland or Holland finished second or third in the group. Both would qualify no matter what, but the unlucky team in this equation would face off against eventual champions Germany. The others would face Romania. Despite the potential difficult draw that came as a result of this, Brian Hensey, who was at the match, remembers that the fans there didn't care.
I think it took us only a minute or two to work that out. You know, you could see that suddenly everybody stopped playing, you know. It was pretty clear what was going on. I don't know how back in 1990 we would have known what the score was from the other game, but we were aware of it. And it became very clear what was going on. And you know, where some of us had sat through the same type of stuff before. I remember a Germany-Austria game, absolutely dreadful at some stage during the World Cup finals, and we were indignant that this should never happen, but of course we were perfectly happy for it to happen on this occasion. Now, I mean, we knew that we were in a group with England and Holland, that, and we were going to come out of it. We knew it was going to come to drawing in lots, or whether we were going to meet, obviously, Germany or Romania. Even at that stage, we were pretty aware that that was the kind of... I think we were willing to leave it to the draw at that stage, yeah. We're very happy, really.
When FIFA made the draw, the football gods decided to smile on Ireland as Charlton's men got Romania. The chance to face off against them in the second round is one which the Irish relished, while the Romanians had one wonderful talent in the form of Georgi Hagi. The truth was that, like Ireland, they were a small nation and one which we certainly had designs on knocking out of the competition. As with the Egypt game, this was another poor match. Chances were few and far between, not just for the 90 minutes, but also for the half hour of extra time. Eventually, the lottery of a penalty shootout was used to determine the winner. The entire nation tuned into this event, literally. The match had kicked off at 4 o'clock Irish time, meaning the shootout began sometime after 6, during the RTE 6-1 news. Those who'd been watching the match on RTE2 stayed tuned in, biting their nails, while those who had unbelievably chosen current affairs over sport had no choice but to watch it, as the event was simulcast on both channels. Remember, Ireland had just 2 TV channels at the time, and both were broadcasting the scenes from Genoa. The first 8 spot kicks were flawless. Sheedy, Townsend, Houghton and Cascarino all netted for Ireland before Daniel Tumofta stood up for the Romanians. His strike was saved by Paddy Bonner, and then it was Arsenal's David O'Leary who converted the 5th and most crucial penalty. For any fan of Irish soccer, this was likely the greatest moment they will ever experience.
Here we go to Italy.
Penalty shootouts don't really do it for me normally, but I mean, it'd be silly to say that I could have sat coldly through that. I mean, when the save was made, I didn't assume anything, you know, I never do. Until the ball actually is in the net, you know. When I saw Dave O'Leary walking up, I said, oh my God, you know, this, you can't be serious, you know, which I think was much the same as Jack Charlton's reaction and a lot of others. But when it hit the net, of course, absolutely. I mean, the family didn't recognise me for about 2 minutes, you know, because I was jumping around the room like a baloo, you know. But it was an incredible moment. Yeah, it was just the realisation that we were in a World Cup quarter final was, you know, way beyond our wildest dreams at the time, you know.
It was a scene of utter madness, you know, utter delirium, complete insanity, and just this weird sense that we were actually in the quarterfinal of the World Cup now. It was just mad. I remember going downstairs in the international afterwards and realising what had happened and kind of slamming my fist on the counter in sheer sort of jubilation. Now, I wouldn't be the sort of guy who'd be slamming my fist on counters, but it was a kind of the sheer good of it, like. And then we all started sitting there just, you know, dreaming of the quarter final.
We were in the student bar in Limerick. Normally it was just full of students and everything, but I remember that day there was a mixture of everyone from kids to students, lots of students still around from college, to pensioners. I remember we had seats, and in the row in front of me were a couple of grannies watching the match in the middle of this crowd of students. It was just a whole community thing. It was Irish people together. And when we won that game, I remember the grannies dancing around the place, the same as this. Everyone was just absolutely, you know, delirious.
In the whole world, in the greatest game of all, so here we go.
Mass celebrations broke out across the land as soon as O'Leary's penalty hit the net, and as Niamh McCormack remembers, tears were shed by many, including some hardened souls.
It's only when it happens you realise just how nerve-wracking they really are. There was an almighty cheer, obviously, when Bonner saved the penalty, and when O'Leary scores there was delirium. I remember that a few people were crying, my dad included, and the kids didn't really understand it. My younger 5-year-old sister went up to one of our neighbours, tugged on their shirts, and in a very small voice said there was no need to cry because Ireland had won.
Ireland were into the quarterfinals of the World Cup, one of the top 8 nations on the planet. It was a sort of situation that even the most heartened and optimistic football fan had not thought possible just weeks previously. As Niall Quinn remembers, it forced several people, himself included, to quickly reschedule plans they had for the 30th of June that year.
I was in a band at the time, and we had a single coming out, and we had, I don't know, I think, like everybody else in Ireland, we had an expectation that we'd do well, that we'd get on. We didn't really expect we'd get to the quarterfinals, and we actually had literature printed up and everything for June 30th, 1990, single release happening. And because like we were only kiddos, I was 17 at the time, and that we'd two sets of gigs planned, the late night one in a regular pub and that, and a non-alco one earlier. And the non-alco one, which was actually going to be the earner for us, clashed directly with the kickoff of the quarterfinals. that like, we thought, you know, we'd be, our squad will be under summer holidays somewhere by the time that rolls around. The next thing, we're in the quarterfinals with Italy and Rome. So we had to bring the whole thing forward 24 hours, I remember. And like, it is a really strong memory with me, because I just remember there was a lot of stuff in the local papers about it at the time that they picked up on the angle of people having to make new arrangements for stuff. There was other people who moved a funeral and somebody else moved their marriage and that, like, you know, because the World Cup quarterfinals were on. There was definitely more than one funeral I heard about at the time, where there was actually a TV at the back of the church and stuff like that, you know, you're gonna or one in the removal home. And any number of wakes where TV was on in the other room, like, you know, probably a portable at the foot of the coffin. Absurd carry on like that, you know. But, you know, the whole country just got carried away in it.
The celebrations following the Romania match were also to affect fans in other ways. Dubliner John O'Sullivan recalls that day vividly.
I have a lot of brothers and sisters and all as well, so we all went up to my man Dad's house up in Black Rock to watch that. No, the place was mobbed. Jeez, there must have been 35, 40 people in the house looking at the game, you know. And of course, we don't need to tell you what happened in that game. My God, every bit of nervous energy I ever had was gone, you know. But driving home from that was incredible, because we had to drive about 4 or 5 miles home. And honest to God, the amount of people that were out on the roads. I mean, there was as many people on the roads as cars. And every roundabout you came to was just mobbed with people. And it was carnival. I've never seen an atmosphere like after, whatever about after Italy, whatever. After that Romania game, it was the biggest high point I think the country has ever reached. I really, the outpouring of joy that day was unbelievable to be around, you know. It was just incredible, the scenes that day. Everybody's out in their car, honking their horns, waving flags, running up and down the road, hugging each other. It was just unreal, you know.
Having watched the tournament on television and having previously decided that the trip to Italy was just too expensive, John was one of the thousands who decided that they had to go to Rome for the quarterfinal. Along with some work colleagues, he paid £500 for a flight and match ticket for the biggest game in the history of Irish football. The match took place on the Saturday night. John and several others flew out from Dublin 24 hours previously.
Well, I just thought, we'll never be in the quarterfinal of the World Cup. Possibly we'll never be in it again in my lifetime. You know, I mean, it was a big deal to get there and to be playing Italy, you know, in their own backyard. It was just, I just couldn't not be there, you know. It was just one of those things, I just couldn't not be there. We were playing them on the Saturday night, and of course the flight went out. The flight was due to go out at 2 o'clock on Friday night, Saturday morning. So I collected him about 7 or 8 o'clock and we went up to the airport. And this was the pre-Celtic Tiger days now. The airport was mobbed. I mean, it was like you got used to in the Celtic Tiger years, but before that, like, the airport was always a comfortable place. This place was mobbed. You went in and, like, there was, I don't know how many flights were going out that night. And all the flights, of course, had to go out in the middle of the night because they were renting in planes from all over the place to bring people. I'm sure there was probably 100 flights went out that night. It was mobbed. Green jerseys, hats, scarves. You've never seen anything like it in Dublin Airport, you know. Jerry met a mate of his who'd been in school with. And this lad was working shifts in a factory. And he had a mortgage and he had 3 young children. And he'd been already out. He'd borrowed £3,000 or something to go to the first set of 3 matches. And this is a lad with a mortgage and a whole lot. When we got through the first 3 matches, he thought, I can't go home. And he begged, steal and borrow, and he got to Genoa. And after Genoa, he had to get home. And he hitched to Paris. And he managed to get a cheap flight home from Paris. And he arrived home. We played Romania on the Monday. He arrived home on the Wednesday. He went into night shift on the Wednesday and the Thursday. And he was thrown a sickie on the Friday. And he borrowed another £500. And he was on the plane out again. And that was £500 he didn't have.
John O'Sullivan and the rest of his travelling party arrived in Rome relatively early on the Saturday morning and decided that amongst the things they should do was see the city's famous tourist sites. They began that afternoon with the Vatican and St. Peter's Basilica.
Roasting outside. It was probably about, probably high 80s, you know, low 90s. It was a really warm day in Rome that day. So anyway, we said we'd go up to St. Peter's because we're only a few hundred yards away. We'd go in and see the Basilica, you know, we might as well now we're here. So we went up and there's only one problem. They wouldn't let you in shorts. And of course, 90% of the people were in shorts. And about three of us had rucksacks and we had maybe a pair of, tracksuit bottoms with us. So that's what happened. Literally, tracksuit bottoms started getting loaned out to people. So they could go in. And to be lads, like, I mean, I'm not the biggest lad in the world. And, you know, there's 6 footers now. I'll try and going in just because they had to have something on it to get in, you know. And it was hilarious inside because, like, I mean, obviously if you're going to visit St. Peter's Basilica, you're going to be wearing, you know, black clothes and respectful and the whole lot. And it was really funny. You see them all lined up in, for confession inside, you know, a green jersey, a green jersey, a black top. It was just the funniest sight, I'd say. There'd never been a sight like it inside St. Peter's Basilica. And it really struck you as funny when you went in, you know.
That night, Ireland took on the host nation at the Stadio Olimpico in Rome in front of 73,303 people. Over 15,000 of those were supporting Ireland. Back home, as Brian Hensey recalls, all of the country, even its most remote parts, were caught up in the excitement.
By the time of the Italy match, I was up in Achill Island, actually, and I'd say probably relatively little sign of it up there, but except, you know, during the Italy match, the place. Well, what struck me was, you know, that absolutely everybody from the age of about 4 up to 90 that was around the place came in and sat and watched that television, you know. It was, I remember images being shown on the news of O'Connell Street during the Italy match, and there was hardly anybody there. It was just amazing, you know. But that was the reality all over the country, all right, you know. That just engaged, everyone just engaged with the whole thing, you know. It was enormous.
The opening stages of the match were tight, and Ireland certainly proved that they were to be far from pushovers. With half an hour gone, the match was still scoreless, and John O'Sullivan admits that in the stadium, fans were beginning to dream of even further glories.
What really amazed you when you were in there was how many Irish people were there. One whole end of it was Irish. I mean, they said there was 15,000 to 20,000 Irish there. And absolutely, it was just a sea of green for about a quarter of the stadium, which was unbelievable, you know. But the game started anyway. And then about half an hour in, I remember it was going really well for us. And I remember even saying to Jerry, do you have your credit card with you? And he said, yeah. And I says, so do I. I said, you know, we're not going home if we win. And he says, I know. I says, I said, no, I'm serious. We're not going home if we win. He says, I know. So anyway, of course, 3 or 4 minutes later, the end of it. And we were right down that we actually had really bad seats. You know, we for 500 quid, you think you get the best seats in the house. But, we were only about 7 or 8 rows back. And we were down, not quite the corner flag, but Jesus Christ, did I get a good view of that bloody goal? I was right behind where your man Scratchy was when he hit it, and, you know, when Bonner pushed it back to him and he hit it in. I mean, I was only 20 yards from him, you know. So anyway, of course, they went berserk after that, the Italians, you know. But we gave them a good game, but you never quite really believed, you know. We were good to defend nil all, but we weren't great to chase 1-0, you know. I think we all knew kind of our goose was cooked at that stage, even though we really enjoyed the rest of the game. We really got behind them, you know. I don't think really any of us thought we were going to get it back.
Scilacci's goal proved to be the only one scored in that match. Ireland fought hard, but their quest for an equaliser was to prove fruitless. When the full-time whistle blew, one of the greatest events in the nation's history was over, at least from an Irish perspective. John Peevoy remembers feeling mixed emotions when the referee blew the final whistle.
There were two very strong emotions there. A real disappointment and a sadness that at the way things had developed and evolved in that game. I think maybe at the time we were content with the achievement to an extent because we had really done so well. And again, the expectation levels were relatively low. However, I don't think either Jack or maybe at the time he would have said that was, you know, that was a good performance. But given as the tournament evolved, he would have been disappointed. There was, as you say, a real sense of pride and achievement in what we'd done. But I really think there was so much more that we could have done. And we were on a roll. We really were on a roll at that stage. If we just got over that hurdle, who knows? We could have significantly overachieved.
One of the most famous and iconic images to come out of this World Cup occurred in the aftermath of the match against the Italians, as Jack Charlton and members of the Irish party returned to the pitch and the running track around the stadium in order to thank the fans for their part in what had been an epic journey. As John O'Sullivan recalled, the fans also wanted to show their appreciation for what had happened.
The Italians all cleared out within 10 minutes. There wasn't an Italian left in the stadium, you know, and there was still 15,000 Irish there, you know, and it wasn't because we were being kept back. It was because we were staying back. And so we started chanting and chanting and chanting. No sign of the crowd coming out, and the bloody police were looking at us like we were nuts, you know. They just couldn't believe this. And I only heard later that Italian TV kept going back, showing the scenes after in the stadium, because they couldn't get over it either, you know. So anyway, after about, God, it was a long time. I'd say it was 25 minutes probably. Jack Charlton came out with three or four of them. And Jesus, I'm not joking you. There was more than one tear shed. Now I was crying, and I'd say 90% of the people around me were. It was just a release of emotion after the whole thing, you know. We knew they were down. And it was really us saying to him, you've given us more than we had a right to expect. And, you know, it was us. It was almost a feeling of, we need to make sure you get that from us. We're not disappointed in you. We're proud of you. And that's what we were trying to get across. And that was the sense in the, you know, and we didn't want it to end with them going off the pitch dejected. We wanted them it to end with them coming out, taking the applause that they absolutely deserved and that they got the next night when they came home. We were trying to give it to them there as well, but they were just too dejected to come out and take it, you know. And that's what it was, you know. It was really us trying to communicate to them our sense of national pride at what they'd achieved in those 3 weeks so that they wouldn't go home deflated, you know what I mean? So that they'd understand where people were coming from, you know, and the pride that they'd engendered in us as a nation.
The team would receive a massive homecoming the next day in Dublin as streets were thronged with those wishing to salute their heroes. However, crowds turned out for the Irish in a different way in the hours after the Italy match. John O'Sullivan says what happened as they were travelling back to the airport that night was a truly remarkable event.
We came off this motorway onto this narrow road, probably the last mile to the airport. And I'm not joking you, the Italians, unbelievable Italian families were out three and four deep each side of the road. It was an incredible scene. All said, we love the Irish, we love you, arrivederci and all this. And I mean, genuine outpouring of warmth. It was absolutely incredible. You just couldn't have planned it. And this was like, okay, I don't know what it would have been like if we won, but they really were. It was their day saying thanks to the Irish fans for being such great fans. They all just felt they had to come out. And they'd all seen this thing on the telly and they all just spontaneously went down. It was incredible. There was a number of thousands of Italians came down to that airport that night to wish us off, which was unbelievable, you know.
The Irish team flew home the next day, Sunday the 1st of July. To those epic scenes I've already mentioned, 50,000 people showed up to greet a plane named St. Jack for the day when it landed at Dublin Airport. This was the same crowd that was to greet the England team when they reached the semi-finals and returned home a week later. However, the crowd at Dublin Airport doesn't include those who went to Dublin City Centre or who lined the route in from the airport. In all, it was estimated that between 300,000 and half a million Irish people said thank you to Jack's army. There were several other notable events in Dublin that day. EC heads of state were all in the capital for a meeting, while, as Mark Fitzpatrick recalls, another notable figure of the time was also being honoured in Dublin that day.
Nelson Mandela arrived into Ireland that day, and the Irish team came back that day. So I was in the airport early that morning going back out to New York, and later on Mandela came in and the Irish heroes came in as well, and it was a very big day. I'd say for Dublin Airport, I don't think you'd have two bigger guests coming into the country, you know. So it was a big day. But I felt very proud to be Irish, and proud of what the guys did.
Mandela was in Ireland to sign the Freedom Roll of Dublin City, officially receiving the honour bestowed upon him 2 years previously. It came just 5 months after he'd been released from prison on Robben Island. And Mandela was, of course, receiving a number of awards and civic receptions around the world at this time. The most unusual, though, certainly came on this day when, after receiving his civic award, Mandela was given another honour by the people of Ireland, who collectively chanted "Ua Paul McGrath's Da," one of the most important men of the 20th century. In a way, this summed up the Ireland of 1990. The nation was obsessed with events in Italy, and on this day, a de facto national holiday in which they honoured their heroes, no one could deny Jack Charlton and the players their moment of glory. It was the last hurrah of what had been the biggest party in the history of the country, and as those who enjoyed it most recall, it was an event which has left a lasting impression.
It certainly would have given the nation a huge boost, there's no doubt about it, at the time, but I don't think it had the lasting effect of bringing on the Celtic Tiger or anything like that. You know, there was a connection, I suppose, a small connection, but I think what happens when you get these huge highs, they do fade away. Something else comes along, takes its place, you know. It had an enormous effect for certainly at the time, maybe, I suppose, right throughout the Jack Charlton era, really, you could say there was a huge interest in the soccer team, football team, but it did fade away. It's no doubt about it.
Coming when it did, the timing couldn't have been better because we were just starting to get ourselves on our feet. You know, we really were. We weren't quite there yet, but it was the start of it. And it definitely had a very, very beneficial sort of impact on the psyche of the nation. You know, it was like, it was a real outpouring of national pride and of togetherness and of we can do it. And, you know, I think it was a real shot in the arm for the people. And I think even, you know, retail business or anybody in business like that will tell you, you know, there was a real pickup after it, you know, and it definitely started something it definitely changed something.
There was a huge sense of pride during Natalia 90, something we'd have loved to have seen back this year. That sense of pride in Italia 90 is still there, and there was a lot of my friends that would have showed clips of Italia 90 to their kids and say to friends who wouldn't have been particularly into Irish football at the time or in particular to remind themselves of how much they enjoyed it, and again the sense of achievements that was right across the nation.
It was the first time and you've nothing to cross-reference it with. The whole sort of circus didn't follow us into 88 until we beat England. It was after that it kind of took off, and there was massive interest around Russia and massive interest around the Holland one again. But with 1990, yeah, it was just a little bit wild because 88 was the only reference that this could turn into a big party, like, you know. And of course it did. We'll never have it again unless we don't qualify for something for 60 years and this generation has completely died off, like, you know. Not have something like it again. And even at that, it's still going to be kind of legend.
Hey, sirrah, sirrah, whatever will be, will be. We're going to Italy. Hey, sirrah, sirrah.
It's clear that modern Ireland, over 20 years after Italia 90, has changed drastically in the intervening period. This may have just been a football tournament, and Ireland may have failed to win a single match, but Mark Fitzpatrick is one of those who feel that the competition had a lasting effect on the country and on its economy.
The only thing that compares to Italia 90 for me was the Pope coming in 79, and the whole country seemed to be on the march. We grew up, we became adults in a way, and I think it's hard for people to understand that if they're of a certain age. We're tipping our hat to countries at times when we shouldn't have been. You know, we're Irish and we should be proud of it, and we've a lot to offer. We still offer an awful lot to the world, and I think we got a sense of being Irish is not half bad. You know, being Irish is pretty good.
Declan Lynch disagrees that the effects of Italia 90 were that profound, However, he is adamant that the 3 weeks did lead to some sort of a lasting change here and are certainly worth remembering.
What had happened in the 80s is that, it wasn't actually all bad. Some very, very good things had happened. You know, you'd have things like the Pogues. U2 had happened. U2 had sold 50 billion records at this stage. My Left Foot had won one of the Oscars. You know, you had the Commitments coming out and all that kind of stuff. What there wasn't was kind of a collective sense of things being... You had pockets of joy and then you'd return to the loom. Even Bruce Springsteen at Slane was a great day, you know. But I think what happened was that, you know, Italian 90 did give a sense that, everyone could be involved. I mean, I think that was what distinguished it from all these other good things that happened. It was the one good thing that happened that involved everybody. Every man, woman and child, like, you know. Religion played no part in it. Politics played no part in it. All that stupidity and nonsense and idiocy played no part in it, you know. Without doubt, it was the best thing ever to happen in Ireland in my life. And I think probably it was the best thing ever to happen in Ireland, ever. Without exaggeration, without hyperbole, I think that's a fact. I think in terms of, you know, the amount of people who were included in it, the sheer enjoyment it gave to everybody.
There can be no arguing that what happened in the 3 weeks of June and July that summer was an extraordinary event, the likes of which we may never see again. The nation was united as one behind a team in green with shamrocks on their shirts. It seems that the performances of those players and that team representing our country in such a major international event inspire the rest of us to aim higher, to push ourselves further, and ultimately to make Ireland a beacon for the rest of the world, at least for a time. For the people of my generation, though, those of us too young to truly remember Italia 90, I believe that two things are clear. Firstly, Italia 90, though special and remarkable, did not directly lead to the Celtic Tiger, or indeed to the flourishing of Ireland on an international scale. It certainly helped in doing this, but so too did the success of rock stars, of films, of Riverdance, of our election of female presidents and many other occasions besides. Italia 90 was a cornerstone in this and was certainly as important as any of them, but it was one of a series of events rather than a single sparking point. The second thing that is obvious following the completion of this documentary is that the Ireland of 1990 has well and truly been lost. That much was reasonably obvious given the immense economic, cultural, social and technological achievements of the past 20 years. But there is more to the loss than just that. The mere thoughts of people, strangers to each other, bonding and celebrating on such a scale and in an impromptu fashion is unthinkable. We've had similar events to Italia 90 in recent years. Clinching the Grand Slam in 2009 comes to mind. But the euphoria and the outpouring of joy was not quite the same, and that's according to people who were there for both. We've become more multicultural, more cynical, and it's almost as if the modern Ireland is less innocent than that of Italia 90. However, that doesn't mean that the scenes witnessed and the emotions felt in that crazy summer are lost. I'll leave the final word to John Peevoy.
It's certainly gone and we're in a very different place right now. But the Ireland of 1990 and even before is brought, in my experience, is brought to other countries as part of a significant element of the away support that the soccer team still has. So many people build their lives around the Irish soccer team and the away trips and use it as a holiday, and they are superb ambassadors for our sport. I've been lucky enough to be with them, a lot of them, in local restaurants, in local bars, not the plastic paddy bars, but in local bars in the back streets and local cafes. And it's absolutely not gone. The Ireland of 1990 is not gone. It exists, but it exists not in Ireland anymore. It exists away from Ireland, at the Ireland away games, with some of these hardcore fans.
I'd like to thank Mark Fitzpatrick, Brian Hensey, Niamh McCormack, John O'Sullivan, John Peevoy, Niall Quinn and Declan Lynch for their participation in this documentary. Declan's book, Days of Heaven, Italia 90 and the Charlton Years, is published by Gill & Macmillan and is available in all good bookstores. This documentary was produced in the Wired FM studios and on location by independent producer Gavin Grace and was funded by the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland's Sound & Vision funding scheme.